Case 2, by Charles Fox. Here's a retelling of the koan from my own stumbling words. The case. Whenever Bai Chang gave a Dharma talk, he noticed an old man who was not one of his students would sit back in the back, would sit in the back of the Dharma hall and listen to his talk. When the talk was over, he would leave with the others. One day, the old man remained behind. Bai Chang asked him, "Who are you?" The old man said, "I'm not a human being. A long time ago, in the days of Kashyapa Buddha, I was a priest of this mountain. And one day, one of my students asked me if enlightened beings are subject to the laws of cause and effect. I told him they were not. And so I have been reborn as a fox for 500 lifetimes. Now I ask you, give me a turning word so that I may be freed from this body of a fox. Tell me, are enlightened beings subject to the laws of cause and effect?" Bai Chang answered, "No." And the old man was deeply enlightened. He bowed and said, "Now I am free of the fox's body. Please perform a burial service for me. You will find my fox body on the other side of the mountain." The master then went into the hallway and told the Doan to strike the densho, for there will be a funeral service for a dead monk after the meal. The monks wondered, who died? For all were well, and there was nobody in the infirmary. After the meal, Bai Chang led all the monks outside, and they went to the other side of the mountain. There they found the body of a dead fox. He cremated it in the customary way. Later that evening, when the master sat on his high seat, he told the monks what had happened. Huang Bo stepped up to Bai Chang and asked, "The old man was reborn as a fox for 500 lives. What would have happened to him if his answer was correct?" Bai Chang said, "Come up closer to me and I'll tell you." Wang Po came up close and slapped Bai Chang in the face. Bai Chang clapped his hands and said, "I thought I was a red-headed barbarian, but you have an even redder beard than I have." Muman's comments. Not falling into causation. Why was he turned into a fox? Not ignoring causation. Why was he released from the fox body? If you have an eye to see through this, then you will know that the former head of the monastery did enjoy his 500 happy, blessed lives as a fox. Uma's verse, not falling, not ignoring. Odd and even are on one's die, not ignoring, not falling, hundreds and thousands of regrets. Reflections. Before giving my own comments, please refer to the monumental study of this koan made by Stephen Heiner in his book Shifting Shape, Shaping Text, Philosophy and Folklore in the Fox Koan, published in 1999 by University of Hawaii Press, a book well worth studying. Bai Chang days was 720 to 814. He was a leading student of Matsu and received Dharma transmission from him. So he came from one of the leading figures of Zen masters whose Zen was most unconventional. The shouts, the slaps, the pushing, the smacks of the stick, the wild spontaneity all stem from Matsu. Also, the beautiful rendering of Zen into the ordinary. What is the way? The way is ordinary, said Matsu. And yet Baitsang went on to create a set of rules and formulations, creating the first Chinese Zen monastery, which were consistent with the Confucian ethic of China. So we have a Baitsang who contained within himself the wildness of Matsu and the conservatism of Confucius, Hongqiu. A little historical background may help. Xenophobia was strong. We're talking about a time in China when anything not Chinese was barbaric. And this newfangled foreign religion from India was atheistic, broke all the rules of structure, authority, paid no respect to ancestors or to the state. And worst of all, turned all of its followers and practitioners into parasites and beggars who were a scourge of society. All of which was un-Chinese and it had to be stamped out. Well, Baitsang was Chinese and he grew up Chinese. So converting to Buddhism was no easy thing. He knew the Indian way of practicing Buddhism was an abomination to his countrymen. He may even have had some of these xenophobic feelings himself. So to make Buddhism acceptable, he devised a way of dealing with one of the major objections, begging. According to the old Indian Hinayana way, begging was intrinsic to the practice of Buddhism. The laity's job was to give to the beggar monks. In return, the beggars would give the laity religious instruction or a Dharma talk or read the sutras since the literacy rate was very low. Even old Shakyamuni did that. Everybody who was a monk or nun begged. In fact, according to the Vinaya, that ponderous list of rules, it was forbidden to engage in agriculture. Farming was forbidden. You see, farming involved the killing of worms and other beings. So farming was out. And since society was basically agrarian, what was a poor monk or nun to do? But beg. In China, things were different. China was a modern society. It was ship-shaped, efficient and pragmatic. Ancestors were revered and worshipped. The state was supreme, the family was sacred and symbolic of the state, and you earned your keep. Baitsang changed Buddhism. He created the first Chinese monastery where monks had to support themselves. He established a famous rule, a day of no work is a day of not eating. What could be more Chinese? Much more, they engaged in agriculture. They worked the fields. They showed their fellow countrymen that, yes, they were Buddhist monks, but they were Chinese Buddhist monks. The barbarianism of India was expunged. They did away with begging and replaced it with work and fundraising. Alas, things were also not so rosy, for in those days slavery was rife. And most of our old dear Buddhist monasteries, probably Baitsang's as well, owned hundreds of slaves in order to get the work done. And probably the meanest and dirtiest jobs were allocated to the slaves. But that also was Chinese, so it's okay. So turning to the turning word or words of this koan, it or they are found in Baitsang's response to the fox man's spirit. There are various translations. Krishna says they are not confused about cause and effect. Hoffman, they are not deluded by causality. Sekeda, he does not ignore causation. Cleary, they are not blind to causality. And in the Book of Serenity, he translates it, he is not blind to cause and effect. Aiken, such a person does not evade the law of cause and effect. Yamada, the law of cause and effect cannot be obscured. Shivayama, he does not ignore causation. And even Papa Dogen in Aishura says, do not be unclear about cause and effect, or do not be ignorant of cause and effect. And in Jinshin Inga, Dogen says, no one can set aside the law of causality. The striking characteristic of these turning words is that they all waffle. Why not yes or no, like in my rewrite? I believe Baitang waffles in his answer because of the analogy of causation equals a relative and no causation equals the absolute. For as we know from the Heart Sutra, form equals emptiness and emptiness equals form. Or the relative equals the absolute and the absolute equals the relative, or causation equals no causation, and no causation equals causation. And Baitang uses the waffle response to say this. He straddles causation and non-causation. He contained within his own person both the wild spirit of Matsu as well as the staid conservatism of Kongshu, his ethic which is reflected in the monastery rule. This leads to the suspicion that there were not two Baitangs. There was not an old fox spirit. The fox spirit resided within Baitang. We're talking of about a person with two conflicting or competing parts of his personality. The koan tells us there's a resolution to the conflict. The wild fox is buried. But is it? The final encounter between Baitang and Huang Po seems to say to me that the old fox is alive and well. And so there really is no resolution to the koan. Or is there? I'd like to offer a feeble attempt at a quantum resolution with due apologies to Mike. Particles behave like electrical charges and or waves. Particles adopt two or more identities, yet are the same. So both the relative and the absolute, both causality and no causality, are true and valid at the same time, in the same way that particles may adopt two or more identities at the same time and yet be the same particle. In this light, Moonman's commentary and poem makes sense. Not falling into causation, why was he turned into a fox? Not ignoring causation, why was he released from the fox body? If you had eye to see through this, then you will know that the former head of the monastery did enjoy his five happy, blessed lives as a fox. Not falling, not ignoring, odd and even are on one die. Not ignoring, not falling, hundreds and thousands of regrets. Whenever Baitang gave a Dhamma talk, he noticed an old man who was not one of his students who would sit back in the back of the Dhamma hall and listen to his talk. When the talk was over, he would leave with the others. One day the old man remained behind. Baitang asked him, "Who are you?" The old man said, "I'm not a human being. A long time ago in the days of Kashyapa Buddha, I was a priest of this mountain. And one day one of my students asked me, if enlightened beings are subject to the laws of cause and effect. I told them they were not. And so I've been reborn as a fox for 500 lifetimes. Now I ask you to give me a turning word so that I may be freed from this body of a fox. Tell me, are enlightened beings subject to the laws of cause and effect? My son answered, yes and no. And the old man was deeply enlightened. He bowed and said, now I am free of the fox's body. Please perform the burial services for me. You will find my fox body on the other side of the mountain. The master then went into the hallway and told the doan to strike the densho, for there will be a funeral service for a dead monk after the meal. The monks wondered who had died, for all were well, and there was nobody in the infirmary. After the meal, Bai Chang led all the monks outside, and they went to the other side of the mountain. There, they found the body of a dead fox. He cremated it in the customary way. Later that evening, when the master sat on his high seat, he told the monks what happened. Huang Po stepped up to Bai Chang and said, the old man was reborn as a fox of 500 lives. What would have happened to him if his answer were correct? Bai Chang said, come up closer to me and I'll tell you. Huang Po came up close and slapped Bai Chang in the face. Bai Chang clapped his hands and said, I thought I was the red-bearded barbarian, but you have an even redder beard than I have. Any comments or questions? Please be free.
So this is going to get you in trouble, isn't it? Regarding this comment, if anyone finds out.
And then podcast.
I remember you were delivering a different talk about this before, and we were talking about the slaves. And we didn't mention it. But this time, you went even further and said it was okay that they had slaves because they were Chinese.
It was the Chinese way.
Yeah. Yeah. That was okay, huh?
Yeah. For the Chinese.
So the Quakers could figure out that slavery was wrong.
Yes.
The Zen monks' masters couldn't figure it out.
Pardon me?
The Zen masters couldn't figure it out. The Quakers could.
Well, it took them 100 years from the first concern which was raised about slavery. John Woolman is the one who first brought it up. And it took 100 years of working at it and people going from meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting, before it finally came up in yearly meeting when it was abolished. It took them 100 years. But they did it 100 years before anybody else did it. And in order for them to do it, they had to be, see, Quakers worked by consensus, so every meeting had to be in complete agreement. It had to be unanimous. So each monthly meeting had to be unanimous. Instead of a monthly meeting, it was taken to quarterly meeting. And monthly meetings are regional. Quarterly meetings are larger region. Half-yearly meetings are larger region. And then there's yearly meeting. So they have to go through all these steps. That's why it took them a long time, 100 years. And Quakers are famous for taking their time. If they feel it's not clear, they hold it for a month and consider it again. And it's really a wonderful way of working.
I can't see it. What, someday 1,000 years from now is going to say about how obvious it was when we missed it.
When what?
How obvious it was and we missed it.
We missed what?
Well, I don't know. It's like the Chinese monks didn't see the slits.
Well, I think we have a blind spot. That's like imprisonment.
Yeah.
The way we treat people in prison. The way we treat so-called offenders. I think that's our blind spot. I can go on and on about that.
I think it's not the only one. Huh?
Give us some more community.
Well, that war is a way to solve things. Mm-hmm. It's been a perpetual human
conflict. Well, yes.
But what was unique here was, I think, not that the culture supported slavery, but that the monasteries didn't, you know, we're not, whatever, we're not, you know. I mean,
enlightened about it? Enlightened about it? Well,
yeah, I mean, yeah, it, you know, just to say when we look back, you know, we kind of hold Buddhists more accountable for having, being able to have a vision in their time, and hopefully we have some vision that we're not supporting the war or supporting the supermaxes or, you know, and so on and so forth. But there must be something we're blind to that we are supporting and doing that we just won't see in our lifetime. I mean, that, we think, boy, look at that at all. We, you know.
Well, we don't see that we're imprisoning ourselves with regard to prison. And the, you know, the whole, the non-separation thing makes war difficult, or suicide. Immersed in Moby Dick, and the, you know, the essence of it is we see ourselves in all the oceans of the earth. And it, I think it, you know, I think there is a decent chance that that will become obvious. And, you know, at some point, science may come along and demonstrate it to us, oddly, give it some sort of authority, some insight.
What I hear you, Peter, saying is that it, what we'll see is that what we as Buddhists were blind to, that we don't see now.
Right.
It's not our society, it's as Buddhists.
Right, I mean, I think we somehow, set, as Buddhists, set ourselves, this, you know, we should get it. But this, you know, maybe the silence of American Buddhism on the Iraq War, you know,
exactly.
It would be more, you know, kind of akin to that, except for the lunatics of the name.
Well,
express their view.
And the silence, and the intentional silence of American Buddhists, at least, on any political issue. They won't touch it with a 10-foot pole. And they were not real happy that we touched it.
But how does that fit into the engaged Buddhism business? You know, the books about engaged Buddhism and the fact that Buddhism in America is different because it has this, I mean, there's feminism and I don't know what else. Well, working to allay extremes of poverty and suffering.
Yeah. Well, the engaged Buddhists are focusing on going to the prisons,
yeah.
Soup kitchens, working with people with AIDS, hospice, that sort of stuff. The politics, I don't know. That's forgotten. I had a meeting once, I think Tigan said, quoting Gandhi, politics is religious. You know, people were shocked. Shocked. The American Zen Teachers Association meeting. People were shocked. And the idea is expressed at that meeting that our job as teachers is to work with individuals and give them the tools and the inner resources or stir it up within them for them to go out and do things. But as a group, we cannot, you know, support any political point of view. That's the idea.
But when you do see religion getting mixed up in politics, like, for example, the Catholics in Northern Ireland, the Ayatollahs in Iraq and Iran, often you think, better not.
Yep.
Actually, they stir it up more.
Yep.
So there are dangers in religious groups getting involved in politics as well. I'm just putting the other side.
I thoroughly agree. And when I hear people that I really love and respect
speak about God's will is not being done by going into Vietnam or Iraq, etc. Mm-hmm. When they're not listening to God, it gives me the chills, because that can so easily turn into the most intemperate and intolerant attitudes. I agree. And yet, I feel we must speak, whether we call ourselves religious or not. And I thoroughly agree with Gandhi that politics is religion. We cannot divorce ourselves from any of this. Knowing, however, that, boy, can we screw it up. We can turn ourselves. And we've got to be very careful, very careful. And that, I think, is why Sangha is important. John Woolman never ventured out without the approval of his meeting. He brought his concern to the meeting and said, this is what I feel I must do. Do you approve of my doing this? And the meeting considered it and labored with it and said, yes, we think it's a good idea. Do it. Follow your conscience. I think that's a good way of working. That's why sound is so important. And yeah, that may be a corrective mm-hmm. to the concern that you raise. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, I didn't interrupt you. Sometimes the divisions along religions are not become something besides religious. I mean, they just become a division, which can be more cultural than religious. I mean, after a certain time, there is no religiosity in it. It's the conflict takes over. Isn't that true in Northern Ireland?
Yeah, partly. I mean, it's obviously partly a racial kind of thing, isn't it?
Which there are religious. That
is
not religious.
I mean, like, this doesn't happen with Sangha, right? One of the problems is when religious teachers use their position of power or authority or whatever to promulgate a particular line, then it gets dangerous.
But yeah.
If you have the consensus idea, then as you say, that counters that.
I also think there's a danger if, for example, the Sangha, or the majority of the Sangha, felt a certain way, let's say, opposed to the war, and somebody came here who wanted the Dharma, who was a Republican, you know, would we drive them right out, away from the Dharma, because they would feel so harmony with it, with what I appear to be the view of the community. And maybe exclude the possibility that their views would change over time because they sat and examined.
Well, that has happened.
And that actually is the view that the AZTA is propounding, that is exactly what we should not do as Zen teachers and as Zen people. That we should be open to whoever walks through the door, no matter what their belief system is, and work with them and get them, help them to see for themselves what their own truth is. And that's exactly why they say that we should not take a political stand, because we will alienate some people. It's a difficult question. It's not an easy question. I mean, with our Sangha, we called, this is the New York Sangha, we called a meeting of the whole Sangha when the Iraq War was looming on the horizon, but had not yet been determined that we would invade Iraq. Little did we know how long before it had actually been determined, but... And we put it out to anybody who was, we put it out on our email list. Buddhists and people who hardly ever came showed up, and everyone who showed up was in agreement that we should say something, that let's not go to war, let's give the inspectors more of a chance. I mean, it wasn't a hard-line position that we, that the letter that was finally written, but it was certainly came as a unanimous voice. It came from the group. There were no dissenters. So, that, I mean, that was how we did it, very much like the Quakers would do it.
Was there any objection to what you did?
From our Sangha?
No, from anyone else. And
yes, so there was huge objection from the other, from the ACTA, other ACTA members. American Zen Teachers Association.
They did not think you should have said anything?
It's really complicitous. Not that we're all, we're all complicitous to some extent. The poem is that the only honest people are in jail.
I just read this book just to change the subject about food and its production. And I must say that I think that's a huge blind spot. The amount of suffering, the secret suffering as well, that's been caused to animals in the production of vast amounts of meat that we require. Really, it's shocking. And it's all hidden as well. We just don't see it. I think that, I'm hoping, in a century or so, people look back at this time and think this was a barbaric period.
Well, I spent the last 2 days listening to lectures given by an Old Testament scholar on agribusiness. And she went back to the Old Testament's appreciation of the land and the value of the land, that it was human responsibility to care for the land, and then took that into our current agribusiness, where 40% of the topsoil in the breadbasket of America is gone, is already gone. And, it was chilling to listen to her. And this woman just spoke worldwide of what has happened to the small farmland, the people who actually cared for the land and tended the land. And they're just more and more and more being marginalized or forced to leave their land or forced to become servants on their own land, what used to be their own land. It's scary stuff, too.
The nutritional value of it being, 40 years ago, is vastly diminished.
We're excited because cancer deaths have gone down for 2 years, but they went up for 6 years. And I just have to believe, that's all the chemical, all the aggravated stuff that we're pumping that have become ubiquitous in the last year. Medicine may have gotten better the last 2 years, but the hormonal things are there.
Creations are numberless, I vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible, I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless, I vow to perceive it. creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Pina. Happy birthday to you.